Hello. Welcome to another episode of Deep Roots Forward Thinking, the podcast series by the Young Lockwood Sauer team at UBS in Houston. I am your host, Liz DeMontron. I'm one of the financial advisors on the team. For compliance purposes, our team's phone number is 713-940-2827. As always, I'm very happy to be here, and I am joined today by a man who needs no introduction, Mr. Barry Young, another financial advisor on the team. Welcome, BY.
Thanks, Liz. I always prefer an introduction, but that's fine.
Oh, okay. Forgive me. Well, your reputation just precedes you.
It's been a while. People may have forgotten. We haven't posted. We haven't done the podcast in a while.
Well, that's why it's so good to be back in the seat. Yeah. People say that you can't time markets. We seem to have pretty good timing on this podcast, though.
I mean, I could imagine a better guest. I'm going to let you do the intro, but we do have a true Renaissance man in our midst today. Glad to have him here. So will you do the honors?
Yes, I will. So just to set the stage a little bit, for the past 12 days, the U.S. has been in a war with Iran, conflict with Iran, not sure what the right terminology is, but there's been a conflict over in the Middle East, which is a huge producer of oil around the world. And it's essentially been at a standstill for the past 12 days. And so energy markets have been a little jittery, I think to say the least, over the past few weeks. And that's had a spillover effect into financial markets all around the world. So who better to have in the studio than a gentleman who's at the helm of a global investment firm here in Houston? So today we welcome Gentry Lee, who's the Chief Executive Officer for Faya Seraphim & Company. Welcome, Gentry.
Thank you, Liz. Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
It's a pleasure to be with y'all.
It's great to have you, and truly great timing. And I did say, I refer to you as a Renaissance man, and I don't know how you were going to react to that, but by way of background, Gentry is a proud Vanderbilt Commodore, graduate of Harvard Business School. He likes to fly fish. He does occasional bird hunting. He's a true family man, a trustee of the Seraphim Foundation, noted philanthropist. Did I miss anything?
No, I think that's probably
you wear
more,
a lot of
more
hats.
Credit than I deserve, but I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, you wear a lot of hats, yes?
Yeah, I do. I have a lot of hats that I put one on at a time.
Well, Barry just went over it, but I'd love to hear more about, your background and what led you to the seat that you sit in today at Faya's.
So it was pretty direct path, I guess, in some respects, because I had a number of summer internships that led me straight there. But as Barry said, I went to college at Vanderbilt. I majored in economics. I then went to Enron as a financial analyst for a couple of years from 94 to 96. I then went back to business school. And while in business school, I did my fourth summer internship at Faya Seraphim & Company. And at that point, they finally agreed to let me come full time. So after graduating from business school, I joined the company as a research analyst. I followed companies over time in technology, transportation, utilities, and the consumer area. And then, over time became a member of the investment committee, took on more portfolio management responsibility, and then Faya's got me to take on more business management responsibility and kind of leadership positions over time. So I've been with the company, I guess since 1998 in that fashion. And like Barry said, have had a number of great experiences really being an investor and involved in the equity markets over that time.
We were talking about this earlier, just an inordinate amount of time with Faya's, and, he has such a mystique, as you said, I think is a great word. And a lot of people, I think, they misconstrue that as the firm from the man, the person. And you probably, what struck me, I was thinking about it last night, that you spent more time with him than almost anyone in the last 20 years and, on a day-to-day basis. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit, like, what that was like, especially in your first couple of years of getting to know him.
Absolutely. He was an exceptional human being and a wonderful mentor and somebody that I really, frankly, just exceptionally lucky to have been able to be around. That last summer internship, while I was in business school, I had the great fortune of being asked to look at the investment management industry for my summer project. And I think because of that, our director of research, Russell Hawkins, asked me at the end of the summer to have lunch with Fayez and to talk to him about my report and that sort of thing. And so that was the first material interaction that I'd had with Fayez, and it sort of opened the door. And then when I joined the firm, you know, I wound up covering companies over time that he cared about and that we had, that he had a level of interest in. And, you know, I think one of the unique things about Fayez is he wanted to be as close as possible to the research analysts that were following companies and developing information. And so he would invite people to lunch, you know, on effectively a daily basis almost, and want to stay close to what they were learning and what they were following. And so got in that rhythm with him. And then over time, especially as we had companies that I was responsible for or had insight into, wound up developing a relationship with him. In the early years, another experience that was kind of formative was I had worked at Enron. I then covered Enron for the company. And of course, in the first few years after graduating from business school and coming back to the company, Enron wound up in trouble. And we had a number of meetings with the company, a number of discussions about the company, and that really helped me get a little bit closer to Fayez. And so that was really how it all started, I guess, in that sense.
A lot of people, they, especially down in our region, they mention Fayez in the same breath as people like Warren Buffett or, you know, Julian Robertson. And I was curious how you react to that comparison and why he is associated with that kind of esteem.
I mean, I think there are a lot of reasons why that is the case. I mean, I think he was an exceptionally good investor. I think he was had incredible wisdom and judgment and patience and staying power. And I think a lot of the same precepts that made Warren Buffett or have made Warren Buffett a great investor, Fayez also displayed in that regard, like an appreciation for what makes a great business, a willingness to own it for an exceptionally long period of time. I think the patience, I mean, one of everybody's favorite quotes about Fayez is nervous energy is a great destroyer of wealth.
Might want to rewind that one, given the events of the last 12 days.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that like you all said, the current events certainly have made some of his sayings and some of his approaches really relevant at the moment. And we all joke internally that if we all got a tattoo, something about nervous energy being a great destroyer of wealth would be the tattoo that the professionals at Seraphim would have. But I think those qualities have been the kinds of things that enabled Fayez to generate exceptional wealth for our clients and for himself over a long period of time. It really was practicing what he preached in that regard, owning these great businesses over a long period of time, letting the power of compounding work. And he would have another saying that was like, if you give me longevity and good health, you know, what you can accumulate is really astounding. So that's why I think the other thing is Fayez was a very, very generous person, not just to the people that he worked with or to his client base or to the city and the community, but really tried to support the institutions that were around him that made the city great. And so he kind of had his own GDP that followed him around. And, you know, I think some of those other great investors that see that responsibility mm-hmm. and the stewardship that comes along with it are part of what really made him a unique individual.
One of the other attributes that I would note, unlike Mr. Buffett, is Fayez's sartorial greatness. He was dressed to the nines every time you saw him. And I remember as a young man seeing him at his house, you know, when I was a kid on Sunday.
Right.
In his study or, you know, or Saturday maybe, but dressed up. It was unusual. I think y'all are probably one of the only firms that still adhere to the tie policy, which I find to be quite endearing and stylistically on point. And what are some of the other attributes, more serious, that have carried over into the next generation?
Yeah. So it's funny, but when you do think about Fayez, you think about that style and really the high standards in every respect.
Yeah.
And
it's evocative of that.
That's right. And so I think, you know, it even talks to the quality of the kinds of companies that we own and the quality of the people that we have at the firm. We would go eat lunch at the Coronado Club and, you know, enjoy a really nice meal there, those types of things. But, you know, I guess the other thing is you always think about, you know, when a client comes in the office and they see you working, what kind of impression do you want to leave with them? And how do you demonstrate to them that you take what you do seriously and that you're putting your best foot forward in every respect? So I think those kinds of things do matter, and they are demonstrations, and we're trying to preserve as much of that as we can going forward. And so we're helped in that regard by having a team that has been in place for a long, long time. So we have low turnover in our investment portfolios, but we also have low turnover in our investment professionals. And so a lot of those attributes or characteristics that people have thought about when they think about Fayez or when they think about our firm, it's a lot easier to maintain them when the team is really stable over time. And so that's definitely the case. But it's put an even greater impetus on having to reiterate those things, having to be explicit about why we do the things that we do, how it matters. You know, when we're hiring people today, we're hiring people that will have never met Fayez. And so making sure that we exude those things just like he did, in the way that he just naturally did, is something that we have to be really cognizant about. We're about to move into a new office, like your nice new office here, and things like having the art on the wall, things like we are going to actually have a little history wall that shows photographs from over the time. I mean, Fayez was amazing. He started the firm in 1958. He passed away in 2022. He had an amazing long period of decades practicing what he loved. And so we have the ability to kind of remember all of that and keep that as a core part of our culture.
I don't know if I've ever told Liz, if I've ever told you this story, but when I first came to work here at UBS, it's like my dad sent me down. He said, "Hey, you need to go down and meet Bill McGee down at Seraphim." So I, you know, went down there. I was like, got lost trying to find the parking place, and finally got up there. And I was completely awestruck by the art collection on the wall and the temperament of the office, and the lady smoking cigarettes at the at the front desk, which was amazing even then. But Bill became somewhat of a mentor, and Gentry and I very much have shared that. I mean, he much more so than me, but I wonder if you could say a couple of words about Bill as it relates to the team, because it wasn't a one-man show. I mean, Fayez, he had a lot of support around him, like making a business and making it intergenerational, which is also part of the legacy there. And the last point I would make about qualitative analysis, which you brought up, is the deep accounting research that's getting done, and in particular in international markets. I know that's a big ball there, but taking it back to Bill, I wanted to say a few things about Bill.
Yeah, I think, you know, I guess from the get-go, Fayez really had a team approach. And so he and Ray White started the company in 1958, but they added employees quite quickly. And that group that joined then through the 60s and 70s became the core of the firm for a long period of time. And Bill was one of those senior professionals that was still in place when I joined. And like you said, he was an incredible role model. He had been, for me, growing up as a family friend, but then also on a professional level once I joined the company. And I would say, you know, everything I said about wanting to have just the highest quality values, ethics, morals, the principles that you hold dear, Bill is as much of an exemplar of that as anybody that's ever worked at the company. Mm-hmm. We would do well to keep that near and dear. And those things are really important at FIAS. I mean, one of the reasons that we typically hire people after they've spent a summer internship with us is because you get
right.
a 10-week interview and you get to know somebody, you get to see them. And it doesn't mean that we're going to be perfect in the hiring decisions we make, but you've got a lot more information when you make that decision. And so, yeah, I think just the focus on quality and high standards is really critical. And if I can then morph that into the second part of your question and thinking about what are we looking for when we're looking at companies? Yes, you know, it's important to us to have a long duration of growth. It's important to us to find dominant companies and structurally attractive industries with management teams that can reallocate capital well on our behalf. Those are the things that we always use to describe our investment process and philosophy. But I would say that especially like here in the United States, I think a lot of us tend to take corporate governance, shareholder focus,
sure.
laws, regulations, accounting standards, all those types of things a little bit for granted. I mean, we know that we shouldn't take them for granted, but the average company here in the United States has pretty high standards in that regard, and the market is set up in a way to ensure that. When you leave this country, you definitely shouldn't take that for granted. And I think on average, the average company is a little bit less secure in that regard. And so as we look at investing outside of the United States, you really have to scrutinize all those kinds of things. What is the approach of the management team? Are they really focused on you as a shareholder? Do you come above the other things that might be important to them? Are the laws such that you can have confidence in that? Are the accounting conventions the same? And there have been times when we've made mistakes because we did take those things for granted. And mm-hmm. so I think constantly analyzing that, making sure that we're aligned with the management teams when we make international investments or that we really understand the situation that we're getting into is critical.
Interesting to hear you talk about the industry, and it's also really interesting to hear that you kind of launched this report, I think you said in 1998, on the investment management industry, kind of out of business school when you were just starting at FIAS Seraphim. You know, since then, we've seen the advent and proliferation of passive investing. A lot of the precepts and values that you were going over have everything to do with y'all's actively managed approach. How has your firm thought about this new wave of investing? Is it competitive? Is it something that you'll view as complementary, you know, especially in the U.S. large cap space?
Yeah, so it's a huge phenomenon in the market. I think at a very high level, what I would say is the most important thing for us is to encourage our clients to be investors in stocks, in high quality equities, to be able to benefit from that compounding over time. I mean, you mentioned Warren Buffett earlier. There's a segment of one of his shareholder letters about the American tailwind. And I think that concept of just looking long-term, owning the great companies that we have here and earning what should be attractive returns over a long period of time is probably the most important point. And you go beyond that, and it's like, well, how can I make our clients as confident and as comfortable investing in those stocks over time? So part of that is enticing them with returns. One of our objectives as an active manager is to see if we can beat the market from a return perspective. But it's not only about that return. It's sort of about how the return is delivered over time, too. So what is the pattern of outperformance or underperformance? When will you achieve both of those? Can you shave off some of the valleys and a little bit less of the peaks so that, you know, you can deliver a more consistent, more predictable style of performance? And how do you manage risks along the way? So, you know, in our case, we talked about quality. That to us means higher returns, higher margins, a better balance sheet, more consistent, predictable cash flows, maybe a superior growth rate. So there are a lot of metrics apart from just pure return metric that might matter to the client over time. And so those are the things that we can also use to make sure that the client stays invested, that they feel as comfortable as possible with stocks as opposed to other areas where we would say over time that it's not that you can't invest or shouldn't invest in other areas, but relative to investing in the stock market, we feel like that's probably the best way to build wealth and accumulate wealth over the long run. And so what can we do to help the client really benefit from that? So that's, I would say it's, there are lots of paths to success, and passive might be one of those, and various active strategies can be an alternative or be complementary or hopefully over time be superior.
My dad used to say that your comfort level is part of your rate of return. And I think that qualitative factor speaks to that idea. He might have stole that from Fayez, I'm not sure.
No, I think that is his own, but it's a good one.
We keep invoking Buffett, but the parallels are uncanny. And one of the things I've loved in his missives over the years and then the Berkshire Hathaway presentations, which you've attended many, is when they talk about the stuff that doesn't work. I wonder if you could recall maybe a bad patch at the firm or when some of your assumptions were challenged and what was done to either accommodate the challenges or hold fast. Where was that? Because I think what people don't appreciate is that when you are working, you're working a seam in the markets, in this case, qualitative or other. It's like that it falls in and out of favor all the time and that your confidence needs to be high for when it is out of favor. To Liz's question about passive investing, we look at it, I'm looking at it, and you see it, and you say, who in their right mind buys anything without any concern to how much it costs? That's not how consumers act. But yet, you have this complete, this huge tranche of investor class, maybe gambling class or not even investors, that are buy indiscriminate of any kind of price discovery.
I mean, there's certainly plenty of things that have gone wrong in the course of the firm's history or in my career at it. Sometimes, you know, we feel like we made a mistake. Sometimes you feel like you owned a company and maybe the company made a mistake in doing an acquisition or spending money in a area that was not fruitful. When something goes wrong, we really try to analyze, is this a temporary situation or is this some kind of real permanent impairment? And if it's a temporary situation, given the type of companies that we own that are really financially strong, that are coming from an advantage positions in what should be very attractive markets, you know, a lot of times a temporary disappointment is actually an opportunity to make even more money over the long run. We could do that by investing more at a time when it's out of favor, or maybe the management team can utilize a downturn in the industry to gain market share, to knock out a weaker competitor, to buy a weaker competitor, to do something to increase their share of the profit pool on the other side. So a temporary situation might be an opportunity, even though it is never fun to kind of have to live through that. If it's a permanent impairment, we want to exit that position probably as soon as possible, and ideally before everybody else figures out how bad it is. But, you know, I'm reminded of things like the financial crisis, when all of a sudden the areas of problem assets seem to be moving from a more limited spot in the mortgage area to a bigger and bigger piece of the financial industry. And we saw that and we moved very quickly to exit as many of those positions as we felt like were at risk. You know, there are other times in many cases through the history of the firm where we've had one of our more significant holdings go through a period of challenge. But kind of to that nervous energy point, typically it's not a very good decision to sell it once you're in that period of time. The better decision is to look and make sure you have a line of sight to how it's going to improve and make sure that you can earn a good rate of return looking forward. That's more art than science too, but it relies on all of the analysis that you've done It relies on all of the knowledge you have of that company and the previous situations that might resemble it in the past. It relies on your relationship with the management team and knowing what they're going to do. Because if you feel like they're going to make the wrong decisions as they go through that, they can make a bad situation worse, potentially.
So, yeah, it's hard to make that call without really knowing the company.
Well, that's right. If you know the company, if you know the market, if you know the competitors, if you know how it all works, it definitely lets you make decisions that you have a degree of confidence in. And that's one of the things that I've always enjoyed about being at Seraphim, enjoyed about FIAS's methodology, is that instead of trying to discern what the market is going to think next quarter or next year, it's really based on, hey, what are the company's profits going to be 5 years from now? And how is the market going to capitalize the business at that point in time? And it's a lot easier to make that judgment than it is trying to anticipate what's going to come down the pike next quarter.
How are y'all thinking about that in terms of technological disruption, which is the new theme of the day? Well, it was the, it's not that it, today is in oil, but you
2 weeks ago.
Yeah, 2 weeks ago, that was the headline. But some of it seems real and some of it seems like vaporware, which is dating me, but.
Well, I think we've talked about it a lot, as you might expect. I think in some respects, you can look at things like the advent of the internet and what it did to the retail industry. I think at the beginning, everybody thought the whole retail industry was going to be going away and that the internet would take it over. And there are certainly places where that happened, but there are other places where the existing retailers have continued to do just fine, something like home improvement retailer or some of the big mass merchants. Their businesses have kind of been unaffected or even positively enhanced. And then you've got a new class of business that was in online retailing, that there were opportunities that were created by the new technology. And some of those companies are giant now. And then there are ones that have faded by the wayside. I mean, when you go to the shopping mall today, there's some missing pieces that used to be there. Mm-hmm. And so I think the main thing that I would say is the market has reacted with a shoot first, ask questions later mentality so far. And what we're
indiscriminate,
sell everything, go to where it's obvious that things are all right. And I guess we've been really trying to dive down a level, understand what is changing, if anything, about these companies' competitive advantages, and really understand like which ones might be affected negatively, which ones might actually be enhanced, and which ones are not as impacted. It's not as just simple, maybe, as the market has made it out to date. I think everybody, that being said, recognizes the power of these tools. They're going to be much more widespread. Artificial intelligence is going to enable a lot more capability. And so you do want to make sure that if you're an existing business, that you're using it effectively or that you're not threatened by it in some form or fashion. So much more to come on that front, obviously. But, you know, I think it's understanding at the get-go that it is not all one way is probably the key for now, and trying to understand, yes, like even in the software industry, if the cost of producing code has gone down, on one hand, that might increase your margins. On the other hand, it might bring in a whole lot of new competition. And so what are the other elements of your business that are still intact that are going to help you fight off that new competition? And if you think that you do have those elements, like other switching costs or network effects or just complexity and regulation and things like that that prevent the customers from maybe even trying to use some of those or putting it way down on their to-do list relative to other things, those are the kinds of businesses that probably have seen an opportunity open up now.
On the international side of things, you know, as an international equity manager, how does your firm and how do your analysts stay abreast and on top of all the developments, especially right now when things are changing almost kind of hourly. And especially too, in that part of the market, there's so many inefficiencies and there are so many informational advantages to gain, but y'all are here in Houston.
There's no substitute for a good travel budget, for one. And I think that's one of the things since I came to the firm that we have, you know, had in place is we've had a global orientation from the start of the company's existence. So Fayez came from Egypt, came to the United States for college. His family had a lot of exposure to Europe as well. But he arrived with a global mindset, even though he started the firm in the United States and our business had obviously predominantly domestic clients. So we've had a global mindset. We've encouraged our analysts to get out to see the companies wherever they are, even if they are a U.S. company. We wanted people to travel the world to see their operations. And certainly for foreign stocks, for foreign headquartered companies, you have to go overseas to be able to get to know the management. Sometimes that's calling on the company directly. Sometimes it's going to conferences. Sometimes it's traveling to, you know, see an operation. But there's no substitute for that. That being said, these days you obviously have tons of technological ways of connecting over Zoom, attending virtual meetings, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, and I would say all of that digital development, all of those new tools that we've been talking about, that certainly helps as well to give you a global span. And again, that's democratizing the business to some degree because lots of people are winding up with access to the information. But I think that puts the onus on us of continuing to rely on relationships, on information that can't be gleaned from the internet or from artificial intelligence or whatever. But a lot of the information that you can get is not available to be scraped into the model, in other words. And so thinking about our firm, we've got to be as good as we can using the tools that other people have, and we've got to be even better at being able to get information and insights and benefit from our relationships that aren't going to wind up in one of those systems.
Besides our trip to Turkey, are there any exotic research trips that you've been on that stand out?
Well, just as one example, I mean, covering the beverage industry. In fact, I had been to Turkey. I had been to China, Japan, Greece, Germany, the UK, all over the United States, to Mexico. So I think that's 8 or 9 countries just following, wow, you know, one industry for us. Depending on what industry you're following, you might get sent to more or less attractive regions of the world. And, you know, I was fortunate to hit a lot of the really positive spots. Our energy analyst, Cody, he has traveled to see Guyana, you know, Mozambique, all over the Middle East, Africa, again, all over the United States, including the Permian Basin and the Eagle Ford and those types of areas as well. But I mean, I liked my travel list a little bit better than what Cody has gotten to do.
In Midland and North Dakota.
But I mean, that's, you know, we have a model where you're always responsible for a number of different industries too. So there's a lot of variety. And if you're attending a conference in one part of the world, there are always other companies you
can call
on. That's
interesting. So there's kind of crossover among the analysts.
That's right. I mean, you know, if you were just a railroad analyst, you would be determined to get a railroad into the portfolio. And our model has always been to give people a little bit of variety because then they can gravitate toward where the real opportunity may be in any given point in time.
Is it hard to get a new stock in the portfolio?
We have a high bar to get new companies into the portfolio. Our turnover is typically between 10 and 20%. And therefore, if you're only having 40 or 50 names in the portfolio, there's not a tremendous amount of change in that regard. But that's by design, because we want to have a high bar. We want to own great businesses and we want to benefit from compounding over time and let those management teams do a great job for us. But that doesn't mean that there aren't plenty of opportunities and our analysts aren't looking for them and trying to recommend them all along the way.
I wanted to finish talking a little bit about, you alluded to it earlier, about community engagement as a broad description. But before we did that, I think I would
I'm
be
just
remiss.
Getting started, Barry.
Yeah. Yeah, we can keep going. Fias was such a great wit, and he had so many sayings other than the nervous energy. I wonder if you could impart a couple more on us, or maybe regale us of a story.
One of the things, and I think this is particularly appropriate given where we are right now, and people are worried about what's going on in Iran and the Middle East at large. Fias had this saying, and I mean, this part is serious, and I'll come to the funny part in a minute, but he started the firm in 1958 in short order. You know, that was right after the Korean War. In short order, you had the Vietnam War, you had a president assassinated, you had the Cuban Missile Crisis, you had a lot of things right off the bat for a new enterprise investing in the stock market that could be challenging. And so he said right off the bat, gosh, had all these obstacles. You know, I don't know that I would have gone into this business if I had known that these things are right around the corner. That turned into a description over time of, you know, I've been in this business. I've seen 9 wars. I've seen 13 recessions. I'm using these numbers loosely here because I'm not sure I've kept up to date with the total, but 9/11, the panic in 87, the great financial crisis, COVID, double-digit inflation, double-digit unemployment, interest rates, and then at the other end of the spectrum, deflation and negative interest rates. So you can walk through these things. They're all very formidable. Again, he would say, I'm not sure I would have gone into the business if you had told me what we were going to have to face. And yet at the end of it, what you are struck by, if you look at a chart of the market over time, is just the unbelievable advance and build of wealth and what you could achieve as an investor over a period marked by all of those difficulties. But I will confess, without that perspective, there were times earlier in my career that I would be going to lunch with Fias, watching CNBC on the screen and watching the red and the market down by a significant degree and, you know, looking to him for guidance. He never seemed all that perturbed. But, you know, on a day that the market was down about 5%, we finished lunch and he looked around and said, well, 20 days to zero. And, you know, I was kind of taken aback. And so then he shortly said, but it's not going to happen. And I think that humor, that optimism, the patience, keeping it all in stride, that was, you know, really, really part of him. And I think, as he said, you know, you take the escalator up and the elevator down and the way that the market behaves. But I think those are the kinds of things that's important to keep in mind when you're going through a time like we are right now and not losing sight of, you know, what will happen and how adaptable people are and how they get through these periods of time.
The psychology of that is quite amazing. And I think we were talking about this the other day, as like when I started in the business in 1990, like I remember just the onset of the first Gulf War.
Yeah, Persian Gulf.
You know, there's been war in that sector, that geography for 35 years. It's been there the whole time. Flares up and comes down, not to diminish what is going on today, but I sort of formulated that into my own quip, and it's quite more seriously, but like in that you can't predict what happens. And I've said that outcomes disassociate from events. And even if you guess what's going to happen, it's like you don't know what the repercussions of that are. And so it's best just to stick to your knitting and, you know, not try to outsmart yourself. And I mean, I've ripped that directly from Fias, just given my proximity over the years. And it's kept us out of a lot of trouble on multiple fronts in multiple markets and in all kinds of environments. And I do think a lot about behaviors around the great financial crisis and COVID. You really could have torched yourself if you got off center.
Yes.
Well, I mean, it's just human nature to try to want to control things when they feel outside of your control. And that's what makes our job so great, but also so difficult.
That's right.
It's our job to maintain a level head and keep perspective, even if things are uncertain.
That is exactly right. If you have a balance sheet and you're in a confident position going into these times, you can really ride it out. And so, yeah, part of the trick is making sure you're in a strong position going in, and the other is not losing faith as you go through it. And in fact, if I think about my career, the only clients that I've seen that have really been hurt are the ones that basically came out, you know, when their emotions couldn't take it anymore. Typically, that turned out to be at the depths of the downturn. You know, as they say, it's darkest before dawn.
Yeah, you have to address risks up front.
That's right.
Before you get into any problems.
That's right. But your point is exactly right on not knowing. If somebody had told us what was going to happen with COVID, all the twists and turns, and you know, I think we still would have failed to predict how the market was going to react.
No, I use that example all the time, and usually around the financial crisis. If I'd have told you that, you know, Merrill was vulnerable, Lehman was going to go under, AIG was going to go under, all these things are going to happen, you'd have put all your money in bonds.
Right.
That turned out to be the worst investment you can make over a reasonable time, and actually not that long a period of time.
Right.
And you've seen this play out, and like, it's easy on paper.
Right.
You know, you have to have religion, I think, to stay in place, and the qualitative inputs are part of that. Pivoting over to the outreach and the community, mm-hmm. This is something that was a very important part of Fayez's life and his legacy. And just the weekend before last, I was at the museum standing in front of his beautiful John Singer Sargent,
right.
Two of them right next to each other, which are just magnificent. And you can't go very far without feeling the indelible touch of his collection now donated, I guess, primarily to the MFA, but not exclusively. But it's all over Houston. And, you know, it's particularly impactful to me because of our love for the arts. And what I pointed out to others that are engaged in, you know, philanthropical outreach is that that gift to the arts has a long life. Mm-hmm. It's intergenerational. And you had a front row seat at the formation and the gifting of all these things and the collecting of all these wonderful works. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, and also his philosophy and what the current philosophy is at the firm about supporting the community.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe taking that in two pieces. One is thinking about it from the art perspective, and second about the community. But Fayez, I mean, that was a personal passion of his, fine art, but also performing arts. And obviously over his life, he built a significant collection of all sorts of different genres of art, styles, ages, et cetera, from ancient Egyptian artifacts to current day paintings. And so it really was a luxury to have that all on display every day in the office for as long as it was. But I think, you know, Fayez bought things that he loved, that he wanted to experience, that he wanted to see, and that was how he was getting a return out mm-hmm. of that over time. Obviously, a lot of them appreciated in value, and there's another funny story related to that. He said, well, the first piece of art he had bought, it was by an unknown, undiscovered Texas artist. It cost about $500. And today, that piece of art is still unknown, undiscovered,
yeah.
Probably not worth $500. But that when he had bought quality, a known artist was appreciated, that it had actually just gone up and up and up in value over time. And so there's a little bit of an analogy to our investment style and how he collected art as well. But Fayez was eager. He left all of those pieces of art to the Serafim Foundation, and the Serafim Foundation has lent the majority of them to the Museum of Fine Arts here in Houston. You know, I think they've been an excellent partner. There's so much art that they will not be able to display all of it. And so I'm sure over time we'll find ways to lend more of it out to other institutions and share it. And some of it is even already overseas. But Fayez wanted everybody to be able to enjoy that. He was appreciative of Houston, Texas, and appreciative of the United States and the opportunities that he had received as part of, you know, being an immigrant here and coming in and becoming part of the community and having success as an entrepreneur. You know, he made the comment that not every city would have given him those opportunities or open those doors. I mean, you know, we had the two founders of our firm are an Egyptian immigrant and a woman. You know, that's pretty unusual for 1958. And so Mrs. White has plenty of stories too on the kinds of situations she faced in that position. And so anyway, I think that is unique to our city, and Fias relished that. And he always thought about, how do you make the city strong? How do you make it a place that other people are going to want to come to and be successful and retain that kind of entrepreneurial ability? And so he did everything that he could to stimulate that. And now I think the Seraphim Foundation would very much like to continue that, whether it is in the arts, whether it's in education, whether it's in other spheres, being able to be part of that community and to stimulate the growth of that community and maintain its vibrancy and dynamism. All of those things are really important. I mean, as a firm, we want to do that as well. We're lucky to have a lot of clients that are engaged in the community themselves. So if we do well for them, then they can continue to help this area grow. I think we will hope to maintain those things and plan to maintain those things as long as we can.
Well, let's not forget the sports sponsorship either.
Yeah. Right around the corner.
Yeah. On this note, tennis.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Y'all are once again the lead sponsor of the Men's Clay Court Championships at Beloved River Oaks Country
UBS
Club.
With us there
and
as
we
well.
Are also major sponsors. And so we love the tennis tournament, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we can't thank you enough for the long support there. And our clients love it. Our colleagues love it.
People come into town for it. It's great weather, which is kind of deceptive because Houston isn't like that all year round, but it's really showcasing.
It's televised on 158 countries, I think, Tennis Channel or ESPN2. I know Fies used to sit at home and watch it.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember.
And he would say the font's not big enough on the screen behind.
But it's just such a great, to your point about supporting Houston, particularly at an international event.
Right.
I think it's just kind of apropos to some of our topics today. But we really are glad to be there side by side with you and look forward to seeing you
at
Tennis Week and your other colleagues.
Yeah.
It's a long week.
Well, it'll be great. I mean, like everything else, talking about long duration, I think we've been a sponsor of the tournament since 1992. And so the folks that run the tournament have done a tremendous job of developing it, making it be a great event. And like you said, I think whether you're a local and you enjoy it every year or whether you're coming in from outside of Houston and getting to participate, it is a special time of year and a great spot.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing you out there. Anything else, Liz?
No, I think we're wrapping
this
up.
This might
we're
be our longest podcast of
hour.
All time.
I know. But again, Gentry's just getting warmed up, but I feel bad to give us the kibosh. But it's been so great. Thank
you
so much for your time,
Gentry.
Happens
when you have a slow-talking Texan here.
You got a few of those in this room. But no, thank you so much for your time. This has been really interesting to hear your thoughts on the investing industry, but also just the firm and the tremendous culture that's been built there for decades and decades. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks,
all
Gentry.
So much.
Okay, this is Liz DeMontron, Barry Young, Gentry Lee signing off. Thanks, everyone.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.
This podcast was edited by Resonate Recordings.